ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. We'll start with a joke for all you Scots.
When God was making the world, he came to the part when he was making Scotland. And as he was doing it, the angel Gabriel came up to him and said, what are you doing now, God? And God said, well, I'm making Scotland in a minute. And Gabriel said, do you think it's fair? And God said, what do you mean fair? What's not fair about it? He says, well, you've given these people a beautiful country, probably the best you've ever made. And the people in the country are intelligent. And I see from their timeline that they're going to be inventing some of the greatest inventions ever known to man. Do you really think that's fair? And God says, oh, don't worry about it, Gabriel. We're going to even it up. Wait till you see who they're getting as neighbours.
That's a moment from a documentary about a Scottish porridge-making competition called the Golden Spurtle, an international competition where all are welcome, including a number of English contestants. So please don't write in. I think it's a gem of a movie made by Australians, some real talent behind the lens, not just in front of it, and you'll meet the director later in the show. First up, though, to a love story.
My father said it was a gift from God, how I could see music. I thought everyone could see sound.
The History of Sound is a romance about two young musicians set before and after the First World War. The two young men are played by Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor, who are my first guests in this episode of The Screen Show. They meet while studying in Boston and bond over a love of folk music. And after the Great War, they travel the US, visiting scattered communities who still sing America's ancient folk songs. And they record these songs with a rudimentary device that etches sound waves into a fragile wax cylinder. Their names are Lionel and David, and they're different in many ways. Lionel comes from rural Kentucky. David has a more privileged background. And only David experiences the horrors of the trenches. And he suffers that trauma quietly for the most part, which inevitably puts a certain distance between them. But this is a society whose expectations will eventually pull these two lovers apart, and they will push them both to try and find their identities in the heterosexual relationships that the world expects them to enter into. They never again find the true love they shared. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart. You know the outline of this story, even if it is surprising how familiar the elements are, given that for most of cinema history, queer desire has only ever been expressed in subtext in films as diverse as Brief Encounter and Spartacus. Of course, these days we've had filmmakers like Todd Haynes, Pedro Almodovar and Ang Lee telling queer stories in the open for more than 30-odd years. This film is directed by a South African director, Oliver Hermanus. And he's a generation younger than the filmmakers I've just mentioned. He's in his early 40s. But the films he makes don't reflect necessarily a less inhibited sense of queer identity. He's drawn to stories about closeted men, notably his 2011 film Beauty, which was about a married middle-aged Afrikaner who falls for a younger man. And there's even a sense of closetedness in his recent English film Living, which was a remake of a Kurosawa drama and starred Bill Nye, and told the story of a man closely guarding a secret, his terminal cancer diagnosis. So you might ask, what's new or innovative about The History of Sound, which is an adaptation of a Ben Shattuck short story? Well, first of all, I'd say that stories don't need to be innovative to be good. They can be old stories, well told. But I think that the folk music research road trip really is the metaphor in the centre of this film that breathes new life into this material. Here we have shared musical passion and romantic love going hand in hand. And yet the romance, just like the folk music sung by these poor rural communities, is destined to fade. And so the film possesses this double-barreled sadness about time passing, about beauty fading. Hermanus is a gifted director, but I think he's better with the absences that mark the second half of this film than he is with the passions that mark the first. That said, Josh O'Connor's irrepressible charm does linger in the memory when he's no longer on screen, and it contrasts powerfully with Paul Mescal's increasingly melancholic performance as a man who realises he's lost the best thing he ever had. The film's softly executed and aching finale just might have you reaching for a box of tissues. Josh and Paul are coming up.
David White.
Lionel Worthing.
What department?
Boys.
Well, fa-la-la. Composition.
I didn't think people around here knew songs like that.
Well, they don't. This is a hobby in the summers, collecting tunes, ballads, songs.
Reminds me of home.
What else do you know? More than you, likely.
Pretty Sarah?
Of course.
Fair Winter?
One went east, the other went west.
How about Silver Dagger?
No, I don't think so.
Oh.
Should I?
That was such a pretty song.
Oh, come on, let's hear it.
Oh, no.
What key? Come on, what key?
I don't usually sing like this with...
With what?
With everyone talking.
Oh. Excuse me.
No.
Quiet,
no,
please.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Now you have to sing. You shy?
Paul and Josh, welcome to the Screen Show.
Thank you.
Hi.
Josh, I read that you met with the director, Oliver, before he'd even written the screenplay, and you told him you really wanted to be in this movie. What was it that attracted you to the story?
Well, first of all, I mean, there was a short story that Ben Shattuck, who wrote the film too, had written, and I met Oliver on Zoom during lockdown. I think both of us had seen Muffy, which is a very brilliant
extraordinary
movie, and we just had a chat, and he immediately got on brilliantly with Oliver, and he's fantastic. He sent me this short story, just kind of, he was really moved by it and was kind of interested in whether it was a film. I read it, found it so incredibly moving. It's kind of straightforward, really. I just found that those two central characters so identifiable. This notion of regret and early love, and the nostalgia of that felt really prevalent. That was really it.
Paul, how did you get involved? I mean, I know that you knew Oliver already, but what was the attraction for you?
It was very similar to Josh's, to be honest. It was one of I was just entering the kind of film industry, I suppose, normal people had just come out, and I'd actually met Josh essentially through we share an agent, but Josh very kindly responded to the show, and we had a Zoom, and it was very like sweet and earnest, and it was like a shared admiration of each other's work, and that had actually nothing to do with History Sound, but they were all in very close proximity. Mm-hmm. And then I met Oliver, I'd seen Moffy, which I'm sure if your listeners haven't seen it, I think we would both recommend it. It's extraordinary. But it was very similar to what Josh said. I read the short story, and then the screenplay followed, and it was just incredibly moving. And I think it was me and Josh and Oliver, there's a shared taste there that I could see the film being made immediately.
Your characters fall in love on screen in such a kind of easy way. I think that's the way the film sort of depicts it, especially that first sort of night and morning together. A kind of unself-conscious way, which is quite remarkable given the time in which it's set. And I was wondering if you could talk to me about how difficult it is to get that kind of chemistry, and whether you had a lot of time to rehearse.
Well, again, Paul and I knew by this stage. I mean, the other thing to say is that whilst Paul and I and Paul and Oliver and myself and Oliver all met around lockdown. It took us so long to actually make this film that we had this big stretch where Paul and I became really close. Yeah. And so we went into this. It was one of those rare gifts where you're telling a love story with someone with such a close friend who you do love and care for very much. And so that sort of influences that.
Yeah.
But also just a note on what you're saying about the kind of unselfconscious notion of early love. I think that is true in early love. You know, you are inevitably so kind of oblivious to the world around you. It's so much about the other person and experiencing another person looking at you and experiencing you in such a rich way that it felt like that just feels like a very natural way of being in love, you know, early on, I think.
And also it gave me and Josh an opportunity to kind of like, I don't know, or just speaking for myself, I had such a like wild admiration for Josh as an actor and I'd grown to like love Josh as a person over these 5 years. But then when we got to filming, I actually was quite nervous because it was like, oh, I was suddenly getting to step into a work environment with someone that I admired so much, but we hadn't, the concept of working together had kind of like disappeared because we were just friends at that point. And suddenly we were on set and I was like, oh, this is a mad experience, you know?
Yeah.
It was great.
It's set in a world where the idea of recording voice is still magic, really, and it's magical to the people that your characters go and meet, your musicologists who are out in the field recording an American songbook of types of people's American songbook, you know, all these old folk songs that are about to disappear with the people who sing them.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if it was, you know, we take for granted how much we can document ourselves today. We can document every banal moment of our lives. Was it difficult to sort of place yourselves in an era where not only is that not the case, but you're in an era where even recording a small section of a song is incredibly difficult?
It's, my eyes been kind of reopened to it very recently in that I've been given a do you know those old reel-to-reel recordings, like the two-track tapes?
Yeah, the quarter inch.
Like, and I've started playing around with that. And I was like recording stuff on it. And the concept of playing that back, the kind of, the value of that tape to me is like emotionally far more valuable to me than like a voice note on a phone.
Mm.
And it really did remind me that like that tape to me is now precious because I remember who was on that tape with me, what it took to make it. And then it made me think of this film where it's like, it's not necessarily just about the sound, although the sound in that time was like, to be able to record time was incredibly rare. It's the context. I can't remember every voice note I send on WhatsApp, but I can remember those tapes. And then it made me think about those wax cylinders for Lionel and David. And even when I see the film, when you see that for Lionel on the sketch on the thing, it's so moving because it's deliberate. There's an intentionality to the recording in the film because it was precious.
Yeah, and Ben Shattuck, who wrote the short story in the film, Ben describes it as like a divine thing. Yeah. You know, that that the nature of this piece of this very tactile object which records sound is such a extraordinary magical object.
Yeah.
And as Paul said, you know, like the musicians, like one of my favorite musicians of all time is Daniel Johnson. And all those sort of fables about the only way you could get a Daniel Johnson album is if you went to his house and went into his, and he recorded it on a cassette, the whole album live, because he didn't know how to
print. It's mad.
You know, it's like that there's something that
it's analog, hard copy.
Yeah.
It's just so, it's so different.
It's like a real thing and it's live and it's personal. And so that's what, and I think you're right. That's why it's so moving at the end, because it feels just for him.
Yeah, it's his handwriting.
Yeah.
It's his voice. It's like there's only one of those. There's no copy.
Yeah.
It's the central metaphor of the film, isn't it? That it links into the themes of love and the fleeting nature of time.
Yeah, I agree. I can't wait to see the film again tonight.
Yeah.
You know, I really can't.
Yeah.
Guys, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nice. Have a good one.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here right by my side. In her right hand a silver dagger. She says that I can't be your bride.
Josh O'Connor and Paul Mescal, stars of The History of Sound, which is previewing in limited sessions around the country and releases wide in mid-December. And by the way, we'll be uploading a video excerpt of that interview to the various ABC social accounts this week, so look out for that. You're on The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. I'm Jason DeRosso. I was watching Jon Favreau's Christmas movie Elf this week. That's the one where Will Ferrell plays a man who's been raised by Santa's little helpers in the North Pole, only to discover that he's actually a full-size human being and his real dad is a New York businessman, played by James Caan. And I was reminded how much cinema loves a story about families who are torn apart for whatever reason and then in some way reunited. And in so doing, we get stories that explore themes of nature versus nurture. In the hands of my next guest, French director Emmanuel Cocol, the idea of two brothers who've lived completely separate lives is the starting point for a very well-made, gentle comedy that interrogates attitudes towards class and culture. The film is called My Brother's Band, and it's about a famous orchestral conductor, played by Benjamin Laverne, whose life is turned upside down when he suddenly needs an urgent transplant. And a DNA search reveals that he's adopted and he has a younger brother, Jimmy, played by Pierre Lotan, who works in a school cafeteria. And wouldn't you know it, the taciturn and rough around the edges Jimmy has a passion for music as well. He plays in the local community band. And so it is that the older brother decides to try and give back and nurture this musical enterprise while he gets to know the brother he didn't grow up with. If you feel like a warm-hearted family story around this time of year that's also got something deep to say, My Brother's Band is for you. And come to think of it, it's a film with a few similarities to The History of Sound as well. Both movies are about music. Both will have you reaching for the tissues. I spoke to director Emmanuel Cocol through an interpreter in Paris earlier in the year.
Tenez, large.
Je vous explique. Il y a 15 jours, j'ai appris que j'avais une leucémie.
Ah merde.
Oui. Ma sœur a fait un test pour savoir si elle pouvait me faire un don de moelle et il s'est avéré qu'elle n'était pas compatible.
Ah merde.
Mais surtout qu'elle n'était pas ma sœur.
Ah putain. Enfin, je veux dire, merde.
Oui. Mais j'ai découvert que j'avais un frère. Et en fait, ce frère, c'est vous.
Putain, qu'est-ce qu'il me raconte, lui ?
Emmanuel Cocol, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you very much.
This has been a huge hit in France. Why do you think it's been such a huge hit?
Je pense que c'est un film qui a rencontré son public parce que c'est un film qui touche l'humain, tout simplement.
I think that this movie really met the audience because, in a way, it touches upon the human side of people, you know, and the audience wishes to identify with the characters, with the film that is watching, and so in a way, this film is a kind of a mirror to most people in the audience that touches them and also surprises them, and the people who watch the film feel like watching it again and coming back to the movie theaters with the family because it touches upon their human side. It's very human in a way. So that's the reason for the hit, I believe.
Yes, it has an undoubtable kind of humanist appeal, this film, but I'm wondering if it touches on ideas about class in France and culture that are particularly engaging for a French audience. By the way, do you know if this played better to audiences in regional or provincial areas or better to audiences, sort of bourgeois audiences in the city?
Alors, je crois que c'est un film qui, en fait, c'est un film qui réunit. Et on dit que c'est un film qui réussit, qui réconcilie le cinéma d'auteur et le cinéma populaire. Et je crois qu'il réunit aussi beaucoup.
It's a film that kind of brings people together in a way. It's a film of reconciliation, and it's something that also reconciliates authors' films and more popular films, and it also brings together classes and also regions, as you said, because it's been very well received both in big cities like Paris as well as in smaller villages and smaller theaters. And I'm very happy about that, because I would call this film a film about reconciliation of styles, people, classes, in a way.
But what did you want to say with this film about the role of, you know, I guess this is a film about nature versus nurture, isn't it? I mean, both brothers, even though they're born in very different circumstances, well, they grow up in very different circumstances. They're both musical. But one has fantastic opportunities in life, the other doesn't. What were you saying about class in France?
Bah, c'est juste la réalité. Je ne pense pas que la réalité française. Hein, c'est que effectivement, c'est la grande injustice de la naissance, en fait, tout simplement.
Well, I think that it's a reality, you know, and not all in France, but everywhere, the kind of injustice in being born in, you know, between being born in an educated, higher level, higher class family, and will open up many doors and will make many ambitions possible and dreams come true. Whilst if you are born in lower class family, the first thing you have to do is look for a job. Up to survive, and then there is not much room for dreams, for higher ambitions, or changing your life, whatever. At least you are not in the favorable conditions to aspire to that. And of course, there are exceptions, but not that many. There are people who became famous although they were coming from very, very low class or very low families. For instance, there is a conductor in France who comes from the north of France, which is a very economically deprived region, but he's one exception. All the others do not come from the north of France, from mining families or working class families. So I think that this reality, that it's a reality that exists, and it's good to talk about it and to say that it is not fair at all.
Is it true that the backgrounds of the actors themselves kind of mirror the backgrounds of the characters, in that one does come from quite a working class background and had to fend for himself economically very early? The other is perhaps, you know, a bit more of a privileged background. And did this influence your casting?
Oui, évidemment, les deux acteurs principaux qui incarnent les deux frères n'ont pas le même parcours. En même temps, je veux dire, c'est pas absolument une copie, vous voyez, parfaite.
These two actors do had a completely different trajectory, say, in their life, in their professional life, and also the personal life. I mean, they're not the exact copies of the characters they play, but it's not exactly the same thing, but there are similarities. For instance, it's true that Pierre Lotin comes from a more popular background, although not that unfavored background as the one that he plays in the film, but he didn't do any specific study to become an actor. He quit school very early, and also in his work, he's got a completely different style than Benjamin. And Benjamin, he comes from a kind of a bourgeois family, middle class family, from Poitiers, and he did the conservatoire. He attended conservatoire and then the Comédie Française, who had a very academic and classical education also in his work. And so for me, it's very important that the actors can evoke the characters they play. Doesn't mean they have to be exactly like them with the same copies. I like to say, when I do the casting, I try to cast actors who will not have to play that much the roles they are called to play, because they already have something of that role within themselves. So something is already there, you know, and so they won't have to play it all. So it will concentrate more, focus more on the things which they do not already have, but some of those things they are called to play will already be within themselves, part of their personality.
Is it difficult trying to portray this world of, you know, elite music on screen? Is it a world that you're familiar with?
Ce qui est difficile, c'est de ne pas faire de caricature aussi, partout, comme tout le temps. Il faut essayer d'être juste. Mais non, ce n'est pas spécialement compliqué. Ça demande, je dirais...
Well, I think it's, well, it is difficult not to give a caricature of those of the conductors, or not to stay away from a caricature. And but it's not complicated. Because it takes a lot of preparation, it takes, and you have to be very close to the orchestra and to the musicians who play in that, because you have to show the level of professionality which is demanded out of them, you know, how they have to be professional, and also the relationship they need to develop with the conductors. So that's the most important thing, but it's not impossible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Director Emmanuel Courcol, My Brother's Band is previewing around the country over the next few weeks. It then releases wide on Boxing Day, a bona fide crowd pleaser. And I was in France as a guest of the French government body for the promotion of French cinema in the world, UniFrance, for their annual international journalist event. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso. Now, speaking of bona fide crowd pleasers, the next film is definitely one, and it needs little introduction from me because I'm joined by the director in the studio. We often interview directors via Zoom, but this director is with me face to face, and we are going to dive deep into what I think is a real gem of a movie. But before we get there, I wanted to start with a definition of the word spurtle. For those of you who don't know, and I certainly didn't, the word spurtle refers to a wooden kitchen implement that's used for stirring porridge. And the Golden Spurtle is the name of the next film. It is also the name of a trophy awarded each year to the winner of the Global Porridge Making Championship held in the Scottish town of Carbridge. The director of the Golden Spurtle is Constantine Costi, and he's coming up after this clip.
I use a spurtle to make my own porridge, and it's really, really good. It's much better than using a wooden spoon. I don't know why, because a wooden spoon's, like, bigger, and you'd think that the extra amount of wood would make better porridge, but it doesn't. So you have to stir your porridge with a spurtle, specially made, and you stir it clockwise, otherwise you let the devil in.
That was my fairly stressful job when I worked, and my wife bought me this lathe. And when I come home from work, and you know that way when you're all jangly and the nerves are playing upon you, and I spend half an hour just turning any old piece of wood, so it caused you to relax, and it's still very much that type of process. If you do more than about a dozen at a time, it can get very boring.
Constantine Costi, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Where did this idea come from? Where did you first hear about this Global Porridge Making Championship?
Well, I mean, in the film, we follow an Australian competitor, a Sydney-based chef, Toby Wilson, and he's going back for his second attempt to try and win the Golden Spurtle crown. And I have a mutual friend with him who kind of told me about this competition. And look, it doesn't take a lot of prodding for you to want to go to the Highlands, you know, so any excuse to go to one of the most beautiful parts of the world. I normally direct opera and theatre for a living. So I was working on an opera project in Berlin, and it was very serious and very German. And I decided I needed to do something a little bit more lighthearted, and thought, oh, what better excuse than to go and check out the Porridge Village. And upon arrival, fell in love with the scenery and the village and just how picturesque and gorgeous it is. But most importantly, I got to know the villagers, the people who put on the competition, in particular the chieftain of the Golden Spurtle, who we follow in the film, and just felt this burning desire to commit it to cinema, and away we went.
I mean, the idea of a pretty, and forgive me for the wording that I'm about to use, but it's a pretty banal subject matter in a way, but the idea that an unassuming kind of subject could somehow transcend that initial sort of unassumingness and become something more profound is, I suppose, what this film is all about. But when were you convinced that there was something more than just people stirring bowls of hot grey mush?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Like, you know, in the competition to win the Golden Spurtle, you can only use oats, water and salt. It's like the most basic ingredients that you can imagine. But I think on that sort of surface level, you know, there's something joyful about kind of exploring how deep can people go with, you know, the most simplistic of ingredients. But fundamentally, whilst the film is about this kind of rollicking competition where people are coming all around the world to vie for oat glory, that's more of a Trojan horse for this story about, you know, what are the things that we decide to commit our obsessions to? They can be as absurd as a porridge-making competition. And fundamentally, Charlie Miller, as I said, who we follow in the film, he is not in good health. It's his last year running the competition. And kind of against his will, he has to let go and say goodbye to this event that gives him so much joy and so much purpose. So there's a bittersweet kind of undercurrent. And so it was really, to answer your question, it was meeting Charlie, getting to know him, and to see the artistry in this guy in his 70s whose palette is a porridge-making competition that really compelled us to make this film.
There's something about competitions, though, that really make for good documentaries, but great drama within those documentaries, because the characters that emerge in this film, your film, are all really quite vivid and striking, and some of them are incredibly, incredibly competitive.
Yeah, and I mean, who'd have thought that the World Porridge Making Competition would draw quirky people to it? You know, surprise, surprise. But
there's a darkness to some of the competitive edge,
oh,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, people do take it really, really seriously, and they're bringing, you know, their own special salt and their own special oats and their secret kind of techniques to the thing. And it is a great kind of hook for a film, because you're going to have tension, there's going to be a winner, there's going to be a loser. So it's very much kind of, I would say, the hook that you're kind of, as you're watching the film, sort of, you know, bracing yourself for who's going to come out on top for sure. But again, I think there's something really kind of joyful about the fact, I think it would be a different film if it was like a more complicated food. You know, if it was the souffle making competition, I think it would actually lose something. I think there's something sort of quite satisfying and quite interesting about how deep can we go with the most basic of tools and ingredients.
That's true, isn't it? As you said that, it struck me that this is almost the anti-MasterChef.
Yes.
I mean, there is something, well, perhaps that's not the right way to describe it, because there's something, you know, very sophisticated about how anyone can make a great dish from such poor ingredients and simple ingredients. But it isn't about making a very elaborate dish or showing off in a way. It's about refining a very simple process, which ends up being incredibly difficult.
Completely. It's so difficult. They only have half an hour. There's a rigorous kind of judging process as well. It's all done behind closed doors and anonymous, and, you know, it's high detail security around the judge's room in the village hall. Yeah, that's exactly right, that it is sort of the complications and the artistry. It's sort of an unassuming vessel to examine obsession and passion, really. And I think as well, there's something so fantastic about that porridge is just so Scottish. It's like this food that really built an incredible nation. And so there's this link, I think, that's sort of like mysterious in the village about that you're coming to sort of, you know, for want of a better word, a holy place, you know, the birthplace of this ancient food stuff, to see how you can honor it in its most basic form. So I actually think there's something deeply human about the fact that it is porridge in the location where it happens, you know, back to the source.
Yeah, and you mentioned that salt is one of the ingredients as well. This was new new to me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try that out.
Yeah.
And then people put all sorts of toppings on top. They reveal that when some of these competitors are talking about how they like to eat porridge for breakfast.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that salt was the magic ingredient.
Hugely important. It's, you know, it's...
Did you know that?
No, I didn't. I was not a porridge obsessive.
I don't think, judging from our surnames, I don't think either of us come from porridge making... backgrounds,
yeah,
culturally.
I think we're from sort of the anti-porridge
starting behind
the
eight ball here.
Yeah, exactly.
I was very fascinated. It's a film that reminded me of, have you ever seen that film King of Kong?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, which is, for people who may not have seen it, it's a wonderful movie that reminded me a lot of this, another documentary, which is about a Donkey Kong,
yeah.
the video game Donkey Kong, a Donkey Kong competition.
Yeah.
And also was an exploration of obsession,
yeah,
really, and competition.
Totally. And it's that thing where whether it's a Donkey Kong arcade game or a porridge making competition or whatever else, there is something about us that we're driven to express ourselves and to kind of to compete with each other and to throw this kind of, you know, sometimes the event itself is almost arbitrary. There's something in us that we want to kind of come together as a community, celebrate food, celebrate each other and really see how deep we can go into our passions and obsessions.
I mean, in the Donkey Kong film, there's a character that reminded me of a character in your film, and it's a man who has this quite elaborate mullet,
yeah.
and is very serious and can't handle the fact that his throne has been taken away from him, and he desperately wants to become the world Donkey Kong champion again. And in this film, you've got this mysterious guy who kind of lives away from the village in a very cluttered house.
Yes.
He expresses himself with supreme confidence mm-hmm. that he's just going to swan into this, after having not competed for a couple of years, swan back into the village hall and just, you know, win in no uncertain terms. There's no doubt about it. And
completely.
Where did you find, were you shocked by the level of investment that people like him had?
Totally. I mean, this character that you're alluding to, his name's Ian Bishop, and he is from Carbridge, from the village, and he won the competition, I think it was about 15 years prior to when we were there shooting, and he's not in good health, and he's decided that he wants to pick up the Spurtle again for one last ride, and in his words, kind of bring the trophy back home. But he's a kind of a bit of a mysterious figure who lives almost semi-reclusively, you know, in like sort of embedded in the Cairngorms wilderness. And we found his kind of ramshackle sort of hut, really, where he sort of spends his days, his satutory, as he calls it. And what we discovered was someone who, yeah, takes porridge very, very seriously. He has a background in kung fu and judo, so I think kind of applies
that. I'm looking at him thinking, I can't see it, but, you know, he's wearing his comfortable jumpers and
I know, right? And then there's this cracking moment in the film where I just sort of ask him, Ian, what oats we'll be using? And he kind of stares, you know, into my soul and says, why would I want to tell you? Other people will just get to know. And it was kind of at that point the penny dropped that this is serious business for people like Ian.
I mean, his house looks great down the lens. It is one of many fantastic locations in this film. But, you know, not all of the village, I can tell, even though you've made a very beautiful film, not all of it is picturesque. You can kind of glean that. However, all of the frames that you have in this film are quite beautiful to look at. You've shot it in a squarish mm-hmm. frame. You tend to rely on symmetry a lot.
Yep.
There are a lot of locked off shots. So there's a sort of overall sense of portraiture in the film. Tell me about how hard it was to make such a beautiful film out of such an ordinary set of locations in a way.
Yeah, that's so well said. I mean, because, you know, under different circumstances, it could be the kind of place that we've seen before, but there was something so special about the community pride of that village that we felt as well. It almost felt like, and this is, when I say we, I mean the team, particularly Dimitri Saunders, the amazing cinematographer who I partnered with, and what we discovered was a kind of, in the way people really just spoke and inhabited the space, that there was a very picturesque quality to the village. You know, there was like, and you didn't make the film, there was a local mole catcher and, you know, people standing up the pub to sing at a Kaylee. And it was sort of like this, there was a poetry and almost a storybook quality to the whole thing that we really wanted to capture. And thus we sort of set up these symmetrical, yeah, stylized frame shops to really get a sense of, I would say, whimsy and almost a dreamlike quality to the whole place. We wanted to sort of to elevate it to almost like a Dylan Thomas poem or something, to kind of make this sense of Carbridge being this this mythical realm where people come to compete with this ancient grain.
There's something a bit Wes Anderson-esque about it as well.
For sure. When you're setting up these sort of these non-moving static frames where people, there's a lot of symmetry and full body shots, that you do get parallels to those great directors that I'm so happy to be compared to.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Screen Show. My name is Jason DeRosso, and I'm in conversation with director Konstantin Kosti, whose film about porridge making, The Golden Spurtle, is in cinemas from December the 11th, and it's a wonderful documentary. We're talking about the formal aspects of the film at the moment, and the other thing that struck me is that you embrace that breaking of the fourth wall. There are moments in any documentary, or not perhaps all documentaries, but most documentaries, where the documentary director is kind of directing the subject a little bit, going, no, just walk to the left, walk to the right. And you've left those bits in, including the moments where they address you behind the camera and sort of say, is this all right? And there's one point where you have one woman, I think she's in charge of the washing up.
Okay, yeah.
And she rides in on a tractor or a ride-on mower, I can't remember which.
Yeah, ride-on mower, yeah.
Right, to get into shot. And it's a wonderful moment where it's slowly... And, you know, a lot of the shots are wide shots in this film. They're long shots. So she's, you know, you can see all of her and the location around her. And she reaches her mark and then asks you if that's okay. All of that's very charming. I'm wondering at what point you thought, these people are talking to me too much, I'm just going to have to leave it in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of potentially indicative of the fact that I got to know everyone really, really well. You know, I made multiple trips. The first time I went completely on my own and just got to know everyone. And I mean, there's not a lot of people to get to know, really. It's quite a small village. And I think there was a kind of quite a genuine rapport between a lot of the subjects. We weren't an intimidating foreign film crew to sort of steamrolling into town. We spent half of our time having cups of tea and biscuits with people. And so I think that immediacy in that relationship, where you really get a sense that people are talking to me behind the camera, felt like an important point to make it feel intimate and, you know, to mirror the feeling of being there and of familiarity. So that felt really important. And also it's nice as well that, you know, there was a danger with this film that it was going to feel like we were laughing at people and not with people. And we were really keen to have a kind of spirit of generosity in the way we made it. And so I feel like those moments of breaking the fourth wall just kind of also humanize them as much as it does us behind the camera.
Yeah, I'm also wondering though, given that, and you know, we were talking earlier about the very competitive people involved in this global porridge making competition, were you ever worried that they were worried about how they were going to come across and that they wanted to control the film? Because I imagine some of these characters would absolutely be the type of people who'd want to have a look at one of the edits.
Yeah, and I mean, look, we were very sort of upfront about the kind of film we wanted to make, and we sent the film to everyone in advance of it being premiered as well, so they could get used to it.
Were you worried about that? Were you worried you'd get an email back saying, hey,
Of course, yeah.
Because that would have been too late, right?
Way too late. And, you know, unfortunately, you have to make the film that you have to make. You know, and if you go down the road of overly kind of indulging what people want, then nobody really wins. But I think it's been so warmly received by the competitors who are in it. It's I went back to Carbridge after it premiered in Copenhagen, and we had a screening of the film in the village hall, which was also quite weird, you know, quite meta, like shots in the hall, and we're in the hall watching the film. It was just such a beautiful event where, you know, I was presented with a handmade Scottish passport by one of the characters in the film. And they felt like really we'd made a kind of a loving home movie for them in a way. And then screening at the Edinburgh Film Festival, a lot of the people who were in the film came, and I think everybody more or less feels like we represented it really well. So I'm quite happy about that.
We've talked about the locked off shots and how there's a Wes Anderson-esque feel to the film you've made, and that you've been open about how you direct the subjects at certain moments by leaving in these moments where the subject's talking back to you and so forth. But another filmmaker that this film reminded me of, and you might feel this is a bit of an egregious and grandiose comparison, but it is a compliment and it is sincere. It reminded me of a Frederick Wiseman film a little bit.
That's such a compliment. I love his films. I know. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, it's you may not think, the listener may not think that they, you know, this film sounds in any way similar, but there is something quite observational about this film as well. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about that because at no point do you go fly on the wall.
Mm.
And there are moments, for example, when Charlie, this great sort of patriarch or this community figure who runs the, you know, who's the central figure of this annual competition, is setting up the hall and talking about decorations and so forth. Mm. And they're clearly sort of caught on the fly, but you've managed to lock off the camera in time to get these on the fly moments without breaking that formalism that you have. How difficult was that to do? And how quick were you working with your tripod to just go, whack, quick, we got to capture this, bang.
I mean, a huge part of that was really a credit to Dimitri, the DP and the cinematographer. I mean, he just has such a sensitive kind of instinct for where to put the camera, and almost like he's almost psychic in a way, that he just knows that this is the perfect amount of time and the perfect position to let a kind of moment marinate. And I think as well, we were just sort of lucky that the village is quite slow moving anyway. So it's not like people are going to sort of like rush in on motorbikes and rush out and we're going to be chasing people down the street. Like, there is a slower pace to everything. And so I think that actually really served us in a way that was really beneficial, that we could just set things up knowing that, you know, there's not going to be a huge amount of movement, that the characters were charming and funny and interesting enough that something would kind of emerge. So it was really just the perfect storm of those things.
Yeah, because there are moments where the film does have that observational quality, quite frankly, and you get these off-the-cuff moments captured on camera. I'm reminded of, there are many funny moments, but it is Ian was the man we were speaking about earlier, right? The guy from the village who believes he's going to come back in and dazzle everyone with his porridge-making skills. He self-mythologizes a lot. And at one point, he's speaking outside, just at the on the sort of front steps of the parish hall with the guy from down south, the Londoner, I think, who is very serious about it as well, but quite an unassuming character. I think he runs a health food store in London and he's passionate about porridge, and he's brought this particular type of grain to the competition this year, and he really hopes this will be his year.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little bit bitter that he's never won, and he's...
Seven times,
right? And he's talking to Ian, and I don't want to make the same mistake Ian does, because I should name this guy. His name is, Brennan. What's
Nick
his name?
Barnard.
Nick Barnard. Yeah. Sorry, Nick Barnard. And Ian, at a certain point, quite off the cuff, and it's at the very end of the interaction, has to ask him to show him his name tag, because I don't know if it's a massive power pivot or whatever, but he, you know, says, I don't know your name. I'm sorry, I don't know who you are.
Yeah, it was such a great moment where two of our most kind of vibrant and interesting characters happened to be having this bizarre exchange outside a private conversation during the meet and greet, and just the combination of Ian's kind of swagger and ease and going, I won it 15 years ago, I'm just going to waltz in there and do it again. And Nick's kind of frenetic, obsessive kind of, you know, micro detail, and those two worlds colliding was just the perfect storm. And there's lots of moments like that in the film where we were like, we couldn't have scripted this if we tried.
But an absolute diss at the end of it.
Hilarious.
An absolute moment of complete disregard and disrespect.
Yeah, well, Nick previously goes, you know, Ian is this amazing figure in the porridge community, and I'm surprised that he hasn't been a judge after all these years, and sort of meeting his idol, really. And then Ian turns around and goes, oh yeah, what was your name again?
Okay, so where have you travelled with this film? Because it has been extremely successful. It is one of those films that kind of wins audience awards and so forth. Where did it first show?
Our premiere screening was at CPH Docs in Copenhagen.
Right. It's one of the really big, important documentary film festivals in the world,
Exactly. Really, really prestigious. And, you know, I don't know anybody in Copenhagen, and we were kind of like really celebrating when we were accepted into the festival. And then...
So you just sent the film a sort of blind submission and it was chosen.
Yeah, more or less. I'm sitting here with the producer next to us and Rebecca
she's
Lamont,
listening in,
I think nodding.
A nod, yeah.
Yeah, but Rebecca, it was quite strategic in the festivals that it was submitted to. And it's sort of this, okay, so it's this great celebration. You go, oh my God, I can't believe it. This thing we made with two bits of nothing, you know, and off the back of like so much kind of energy and late nights and hours being put in. We didn't have a huge operation behind us supporting the film. To get accepted to a festival like CPH was amazing. And not only that, it wasn't like a screening in Sydney where there's lots of friends and family and I don't know any Danish people. And at that first screening, it was packed. And people were laughing and they were moved. And I did a Q&A afterwards and, you know, a third of people put their hands up with these amazing questions. And we went on to sell out all of these screenings to almost double with additional screenings. And it was a really kind of pinch yourself kind of moment going, oh my God, this thing that we made so kind of humbly is having this impact on the other side of the world. It was truly gobsmacking. And this year alone, and I've been to Poland, I've been to Spain, I've been to Zurich, I've been to Hawaii, where else? Like countless others.
Yeah.
Yeah, Telluride Film Festival
Telluride. Okay,
in the
US.
That's
a big one.
Huge.
Thank you, Rebecca. That's Rebecca
you,
off mic.
Yeah, right. Yeah, reminding us of the jewel and the crown in a way.
And how much does the sort of, I guess, fame and charm of this film precede it now that it has started to go around the world and people, I guess, have a sense of how much other people have liked this film and via, you know, sites like Letterboxd, I suppose, people read reviews. But you've also got a lovely poster.
Yes.
That sort of cartoonifies some of the, well, some of the major characters in the documentary.
Yeah.
And I think introduces a sense of what the tone of the film will be.
Yeah,
there's
completely
a quirkiness to the poster.
Yeah.
So do you think, is it a film now that whose fame precedes it and whose reputation precedes it?
I think so. I think that's such a great compliment that I think the way that the team have marketed it, it feels very inviting. It's the kind of film that you kind of want to see and you know you're going to enjoy because it's funny and it's quirky and it's charming. And I think, yeah, it has sort of taken on a life of its own, particularly as it's hit cinemas and other parts of the world as well. We're doing really well in the Netherlands in cinemas. So I think a huge part of it, like anything, word of mouth, I think, has been the main thing, that people are just seeing this film and saying to their friends and family, you've got to go and see the Porridge documentary. Who'd have thought? It's so surreal. Yeah. I actually feel like I'm going to wake up, you know, being like, oh yeah, what a weird dream.
You've got to go and see the Porridge documentary. And that's my film. I've made that.
Yeah, I feel very, very lucky.
Beautifully made. And we've spoken about Dimitri Saunders and there is a kind of interconnection between this film and, you know, a film like James Vaughan's Friends and Strangers.
Yes, dear childhood friend of mine. We grew up together, James
okay.
and I.
So this is a film that comes out of a similar milieu of people and collaborators and shares some of the collaborators.
Yeah.
And so and when you watch it, I think the proof is on screen. You're watching something that aesthetically is really well made and conceived very well, I think, right down to the font. The other thing we were talking about just before going on air is that these individuals, and you've already spoken about how you didn't want to make fun of them. You didn't want and it's not a film where you're laughing at them at all. These are very erudite individuals in some ways. And I think it talks about their, well, in terms of the older individuals, their education, the quality of education perhaps.
Yeah, really interesting.
Because these are working class people, but they quote the Bible, quote all sorts of things that are very interesting.
Completely. And that was another thing that felt so perfect. Like, and you know, we follow a lot of older people. And as you say, like Charlie grew up in council housing in Govan in Glasgow, for anyone who knows, would have been quite a rough environment when he was a young guy in the 50s and the 60s. But the way he kind of speaks with this gorgeous poetic meter and rhythm is so Scottish, and you can sort of feel this sort of poeticism going back to people like Robert Burns. And I think it's indicative of an education system where there was a lot more recitation, memorizing. You learn your Bible verses, you learn your poetry, you stand up in class and say them, you know, unprompted. And I think that sort of has made its way into the way a generation talk. And some of the greatest moments that I'm really proud of do come from people like Charlie, where I wasn't prompting with questions and people just are sort of musing out a window, and some of the most stunning sentences come out of their mouths from deep within their kind of philosophical souls in such a humble way. So I think we really captured something kind of special in that.
Constantine, congratulations on the film. I hope people get along to see it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on The Screen Show.
Such a pleasure. Thanks.
Constantine Costi, director of The Golden Spurtle, which releases next week, December 11, in Australian cinemas. Do yourselves a favour. I'm Jason DeRosso. This has been another episode of The Screen Show, brought to you with love and devotion by ABC Radio National. The producer is Sarah Corbett and ABC Radio National's arts editor is Rhiannon Brown. Bye for now. Don't forget to enjoy some porridge.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.